Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Hey, y'all, check out my new t-shirt. This is the Native Chalk Talk Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Chuta t-shirt. I've also got sweatshirts, cups, all kinds of things, and a portion of proceeds goes to support the cause. Simply go to cafepress.com/Native Chalk Talk shop, and we really appreciate all your support, and please pray for the families and the victims. Yakoki.
So we've talked about your dad's side. Why don't you tell us about your mom's dad, so your grandpa on that side?
Okay. My Che, what we call in the Navajo language, me and my maternal grandfather, his name was Ned Cly, and he was born behind the Three Sisters Monument in what is now called the Navajo Minot Valley Tribal Park. So that's where he grew up in that area. So when he was younger, all he was doing was herding sheep and stuff like that. And that's how he was brought up, doing all the male duties and stuff like that.
Yeah. So
when it was time to get married, his family went into an area called Narrow Canyon, which is probably 30 miles west of Minot Valley. His family asked my grandmother's family for hand in marriage of my grandmother, but which sort of arranged marriage too, and they never met until the day of their wedding. He moved to Narrow Canyon area, lived among the Tlazitlana clan, which means many ghost clan, and my Che was a Kiaani, which means towering house clan, so it was okay for to make that connection. It's not the same clan wise, so that was okay.
Right.
So then they raise their kids. I believe there was maybe 10 to 11, which were my aunts and uncles.
Wow.
Through herding sheep. My grandpa also had to go to work. So the first thing he was doing was, the way my mom told me, was that he worked in the uranium mines nearby the home. They didn't know what the material was. I mean, they just was told to go into these mines.
Oh, really?
The ore of the uranium. He would come home, and my mom said she remembers washing his clothes of these dust that he brought home at the local creek. So then he would go back into mines and did that for a while. And then during World War II, he went to Belmont, Arizona, near Flagstaff, and made ammunition and bombs, whatever, at that location. So, and then later in 1980 is when he started working for Peabody Coal Company on Black Mesa. So he did that for maybe 20 years until he retired in his early 70s and went back to herding sheep. But he was a strong person too. He's always planting corn during the season, every season. Anything, like I said, from corn to watermelon, potatoes, and beans and squash. And he gave those out to my grandma's family, relatives. My grandma had sisters, so they had family members there that he would share the food to. So, and he also, I remember one time too, we went hunting for bluebirds. Bluebird is sort of sacred bird in our traditional ceremonies. So he would go hunt for those and wrap those up, so it's sort of like still in good shape and use that in the ceremonies. And then
Yeah.
he grew peaches too, and not too far there was huge peaches farm that he had there, and just really, and again he helped during the summer and winter ceremonies too with the wood, water to the ceremonies, and also he would participate, sing along at these ceremonies and be part of the ceremonies. So,
And in the ceremonies, is there drumming and
yeah, there
dancing?
was drumming, and someone would drum and special. They call it water, sort of like a water drum, like small clay
Right.
type with the animal skin wrap on top of it, and just use that to sing. So.
Well, and you must remember him because you were talking about him and you said he was a hardworking Diné man for his family and a rich traditional life. He was a quiet and humble man, but raised his voice when he needed to. I always think of him when I see the three sister figure in photos and think that the Monument Valley area was his playground before the tribal park was established. I think that's so such a beautiful tribute to your grandpa. How old were you when he passed away?
He passed away in 2006.
Okay.
He was probably around 80 years old, maybe. But
Yeah.
I mentioned also my maternal grandmother was a medicine woman later in life. And long story short, a lot of people used to visit my grandparents, especially her, because she had special power or special way of healing people, and in the traditional way, the Hajong way, and she was sing a lot in these traditional songs, and I remember some of that. So,
That's so nice. Did she ever help you when you were ill
oh
or
yeah,
anything?
yes, she did help me a lot growing up. My mom would always take me, my siblings, up there before this start of the school, and she would perform a ceremony for us to do good.
Oh, I love that.
I remember in when probably about 11th grade, I never flew on a plane before, and my mom took me to see my grandmother to do that special blessing ceremonies that, so nothing will happen when I'm on the plane to go to Washington, D.C.
What a special thing that she could, a gift for you. You know, I mean, what better gift than that? Now, your grandpa though, he was in a movie or something, right?
Oh yeah, him being from Minot Valley in 1960s to the early 1970s, there was a movie maker called John Ford that brought movie stars like John Wayne to the area, and they shot these movie sets on in the Minot Valley area. So
Wow.
he was sort of cast as a minor roles, like just maybe like riding a horse or something,
That's amazing.
so he was able to do stuff like that. So.
I bet ga that gave him some street cred in the tribe,
Yeah,
right?
correct. So he did. I know there's other family members and relatives of his that were also in this movie. So.
And by the way, for people who are listening and not watching this video, I'm going to be showing some of those photos. These are very precious photos of Stanford's life and family and ancestors on my Native Chalk Talk Facebook page. But if you're watching this YouTube video, you're also going to see some of those photos throughout this video to kind of put those names with faces because we do want to honor Stanford's ancestors and family. What other ancestral stories would you like to share with us? Just
I would say it was never shared with me, but it was sort of hinted because it was considered a dark time for the Navajo people. They call it the Long Walk, 1864. One of the, I guess, in the U.S. history, they consider him a famous officer, Kit Carson. He was assigned to Yeah, they're all the Navajos in 1863, 1864, and moved them to a location called Bosque Redondo Huelte, as we call it in the Navajo language. Yeah, this is on the eastern side of the New Mexico area. And so, from my research, Navajos were in different groups, meaning clanship, and they weren't all as one united tribe. There were just different regions, different places that they all were in their own group. So one group might be being attacked by the other tribes, like the Ute or the Paiute, or vice versa, and they were and causing trouble, but some of these other Navajos were peace. They call it peaceful Navajos, and because of that, the U.S. government thought that the tribe was as a whole nation. They didn't know that there were all these different groups of Navajos that did their own thing. So the government decided to, well, we need to get these Navajos marching to this new fort called Fort Sumner in Bosque Redondo, and beyond this small reservation, I guess you call it a reservation, and with another tribe, the Mescalero Apache. So they were rounded up and taken to this location, and about somewhere around 8,000 plus were rounded up, and only about maybe 6,000 to 7,000 made it to this on this long walk. The others perished away because they were probably older or they were too weak to make this trip, so they were shot on the spot. And anyway, so this was a dark time for the Navajos. But in my own family, on my mother's side, there was on my maternal side Chief Meshke Nanini, which means the angry one in the Navajo language. He took his band of Indians or band of Navajos to a place called Navajo Mountain, another sacred mountain in the northwestern part of the current Western Navajo Nation. So he took his family and his clans, men, to that location and hid in the canyons for those 4 years. From the research I've done and the stories I heard was that he took only 20 sheep with him and was able to have over 2,000 sheep later on when so he hid in these rugged canyons. I know because I've been there during one of my training runs when I was running the area, and also I ran with the at the time the vice president Jonathan Nez. We went from Navajo Mountain to Minot Valley, so I know what areas they were at and what they
What
were
does that terrain
hiding.
look like? It's
And
probably
it's,
hot, sun.
so this area is hot, but there's a lot of springs in the area, water that comes out from the side of these canyons, and they were able to move to area where these springs came up, and they planted and we hid very well from the U.S. soldiers, and stayed hidden, developed a flock of sheep, and a lot of they stored a lot of food, the corns, stuff like that. So when the Navajos came home, they were empty, and they didn't have anything. And so this chief, Ishken Nenini, gave some of that to the Navajos that returned in the region. And after that, they call him the generous one. So
Oh, really? That's what his name means? Or that's just what they
later
call him?
on, the generous one, yeah. His, like I said, his name is Ishken Nenini, which means angry. It's really when back then, Heshke was given as this as a name to some of our warriors, both in the war or also in the peaceful. They were given these names. The women that went to also war, they were given something like Nunaba or something like that, like the
So there
Ba.
were women that went into war as well, huh?
Yeah. Sort of went to wars, but sort of in a special way. So
What an
Nuzbot, that's what
interesting.
it's called, Nuzbot. So it's there's Navajo that had these woman Navajos that had these Nuzbot in their names and stuff like that.
So
Where
fascinating.
the man had this Heshke, sort of like angry, but the meaning also they had this deep, I guess a feeling or like a strong name to their names and stuff like that.
Right. So was it typical for the women to go into battle as well, or was it getting to the point where the Navajo were reducing in size and everybody had to come to battle?
It was more the males were in these battles, but from my reading that if there's a small group of Navajos band, then this whole family or clans would all go to war, and they all had special duties in a way that they went to wars and stuff like that. So, and then so as like I said, researching this three times great grandfather that had this chief Ishkenini, and then one time I was running through a street here in Prescott, Arizona. West Prescott, and I came across his name in the street.
You
It's
did?
Ashkenani Street or something like that. And I was surprised, like, and so I went back and Googled that. And sure enough, in that area, all these different name Navajo name, not Navajo names, but Navajo places. And his was the only one that had the Navajo name associated with it. And it's like, wow, I wonder how that came about. So and I was thinking also that in those times, the early late 1800s to early 1900s, that's when he was living, he befriended traders, the Wetherells, they're called the Wetherells, both John and Laura Wetherells. They set up a trading post in Old Jato near Minot Valley area, and he befriended them. And the lady, actually, the Anglo lady, Laura Wetherells, she taught herself how to speak Navajo, and she was able to be a mother figure to a lot of the Navajos in the area.
So
So
neat.
when before she passed away, she sort of was put into a nursing home, I believe, or a living facility here in Prescott, Arizona. And I guess the local museum kept the archive a lot of this stuff. So I think the society here in Prescott came across this store, this lady, and befriended this Navajo chief from Minot Valley area. So maybe that society decided to name the street after this
There you go.
warrior or
That makes
something.
sense. That would make sense. That's so fascinating.
That's one thing I learned.
Yeah.
And then I also remember when my uncle is special to me, also my dad's younger brother that passed away probably about 6 years ago. He also was a medicine man in religion called the Native American Church. So he was considered a roadman, a medicine man that used the Izzet, which means medicine in the Navajo language. So I remember him doing a prayer, and he brought in the name Eshkenini and sort of as a remembrance. And that's how I also thought about the special person, and that's how I gathered these information about where I fall from this three times great grandfather that I had. So
We don't want those warriors to be forgotten. There are some warriors out there that they are the reason that some of the descendants are here today, or the people that did survive that walk that you talked about, which is equivalent to some of our, Trail of Tears for some of our ancestors.
that you are here today, maybe because of some of those people that survived that walk.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you looking for the perfect gift for your significant other, your bestie, or even yourself? You know you're worth it. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted, and they make the perfect gifts. This work of art is their signature turquoise soap, and it's made to look like Sleeping Beauty turquoise. Do you see this gold veining throughout? And the gold marbling on top? Love it. Next, check out this Apple Mint custom fragrance oil soap called Say Their Name. And all proceeds go to the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Choctaw cause. You'll only find this blend made specifically for this soap. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, which leaves your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCKTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
What can you tell us about the Navajo clans? And, you know, you talked about clans earlier and the culture and traditions.
Yeah, I guess I mentioned earlier in our podcast about I introduced myself in the Navajo language. So, and each of us Navajos have a four clan system to us. Our main clan is the clan of our mother, and then we're born into our father's clan.
And then, okay.
And then the other acknowledgement is your Che, which is my maternal grandfather, his clan, and then my paternal grandfather's clan, and which is my Nali. And those four sort of make up our own, as a person, or I guess you can call it a DNA system within the Navajo culture, Navajo kinship. And we use that to always introduce ourselves to other Navajos. But back in the old days, I believe it was used often during ceremonies, during introduction to other families that are in the area. So, but nowadays it's been not used as much. For myself, I use it a lot in the business setting when I'm doing a lot of work with the Navajo Nation, with the different departments. I always introduce myself at these meetings or these events. So that always, there might be a family member in the clanship that, and they'll
greet me in a
certain area.
Right. And I think it's nice that you're keeping it alive. I wish more people would do that.
So again, on the clanship too, what my reading from the history back to late 1800s, I guess it was really considered really sacred enough that when you went to a place, maybe another region, and you came across a relative clan, they'll bring you in as if they were your own family. They would feed you, give you shelter, and make sure that you're taken care of. So that's how important it was, a piece at that time. And that's how it was, some of my research and some of the books I had read from these bibliography of these Navajo people that lived back then. So it's just really interesting how that was really considered sacred. So now it's more of, it's not common, because I think it's because we all move off the reservation, or when we're not tied to the culture as much. So,
well, as a Choctaw, I don't know if I've earned the right to say this, but if there are any Diné people out there that would like to start bringing this back along with Stanford, please do. I'm sure your ancestors would thank you if they could. So when it comes to something that has also become very commercialized, but I'm a huge fan of, is a fry bread. And a lot of people call it Indian tacos or just fry bread or Navajo fry bread.
Growing up, it was always called fry bread. I see the elder ladies cooking it over the Crisco oil, having a the bluebird flower, the shorten,
Yep.
all that that you saw at these ceremonies or even at the local flea market or something like that. Or even now you see it in restaurant. And I just visit
It's amazing, isn't it?
yeah, I just visit a restaurant a month ago in Phoenix. I think it's called Val's Fry Bread. So this restaurant in Mesa, and so she developed this thing, the fry bread, and she's able to use that to have a different menus.
That's amazing. You can do
So
so much with fry bread too,
yeah.
so might as well.
So anyways, I think it from my again my reading, it originated just right after the long walk, because during after the long walk, the U.S. the treaty was that some of that the U.S. government would provide basic needs for the Navajo people, and they would do food distribution to the Navajo in Fort Defiance near Window Rock, current near the current Window Rock, Arizona. So these food rations or food distribution was a lot of it was like coffee, beans,
Bad meat.
flowers, and just things that, yeah, just things. So I think it developed into a way, how can we use this? So I think that's where hybrid started from, and that's another way that it is came part of the culture, or even the Indian tribes. Other Indian tribes might have similar things, like you mentioned the Trail of Tears. So the federal government afterwards gave these different tribes these different
Kind of like rations, like
rations. Yeah,
there's some
so
flour and some bad meat, and I don't know what else, oil.
oil, and then they probably developed their fry bread through that. So
There's all these different flavors of the fry bread from all the, many different tribes nowadays, and it's becoming a lot more common. My daughter went to college in Connecticut, and there's actually a Native American restaurant there near campus, and it's a beautiful restaurant that has Native American paintings in it, and they serve fry bread there as well. But it is so fancy. It's got like feta cheese and arugula and bacon, and very different from any kind of fry bread I'd had before. It's how they do it in the Northeast, I guess.
yeah.
I wanted to make a disclaimer. So I spent time when I was younger, just one time, but in at Black Mesa in the Panhandle of Oklahoma. I'm saying this because that is not the same Black Mesa that Stanford is talking about for you listeners. So what he's talking about is in a whole other state. Black Mesa, the mountain kind of plateau that some of us visit to go see Halley's Comet or whatever the case is, that's a different Black Mesa, because I know I'm going to have questions about that. You once told me that your wife also grew up on the reservation as well, but that's not where you met, right? Where did y'all meet?
I met her at Northern Arizona University at a summer school, I guess you'd call it a program, right after high school. I
Nice.
met her in the program, and then we started dating that fall. And a year later, we got married and we had our daughter. And she decided not to go back to school, took care of her daughter. Her
Oh,
name is Sean Dean, which means sun ray in the Navajo language.
that's beautiful.
So I, after that, supported the family by going to school and also working through when I was going to school until I graduated. Right when I was graduating, we had our second child, which is our son, Nakai, which means one who walks around in Navajo language. So he was born in late part of my college year, and once I graduated, I needed work right away, so I decided to move to Prescott because that was the only place I can get a job offer as an engineer, and in here in Prescott, Arizona, since so.
Ah, so that's how you got to Prescott, I wondered.
Right.
So shout out to your family. And what's your
Thank
wife's
you,
name?
Vonnie,
And to Bonnie.
with the V.
Oh,
So,
Bonnie. Nice to meet
right.
you, Bonnie. So I also wanted to bring up the fact that you mentioned earlier a run that you've done, but you're quite active with lots of running and golfing and hiking, correct?
That's correct. The running stuff came back in 2015. It was to combat early stage pre-diabetic, and high blood pressure and stress from work. So I decided to do that. But also, it was a time when my son Nakai was actually involved with ultra running. They call it. It's a distance that's over 26.2 miles or more. So he was real when he was like 14, 15 years old, he really got involved with this sport. And I thought he's crazy. These 25-hour run or these 50-mile runs. And I
can't even imagine. No thanks.
Body over time.
Right.
But anyways, he did that and it became sort of an aid person to him, and my family was also involved helping him at these different stages.
Awesome. Yeah.
So, and then I became partially a pacer to him, and slowly I developed into that sport. And because one thing, I needed to get healthy because of this pre-diabetic stage, and decided to do that. So
it's fantastic. That's very inspiring too. And it's interesting that Coach James Nels was a runner as well. So is that pretty popular among the Navajo to be running as a big sport for y'all, or is that just coincidence?
I guess in my growing up is more of a sport to do. And some of us did cross country. Some of us did football, basketball.
Yeah.
And, but also, when we were younger, I know my dad used to wake us up early in the morning before the sunrise and tell us to go run to the east direction to greet our holy people and tell us to yell out loud to make sure that you're present among the holy people. So it's sort of he said there used to be a tradition when he was younger and generation before that running was part of our culture back then. So
wow, that brings everything full circle, doesn't it?
Yeah. And some of our ceremonies still have those running part of the piece. Like one of them is the Kinalita, which means the changing of growth to womanhood. So my daughter went through that ceremonies when she was younger, like when she was probably 14. And I took part with her in the morning to go east 4 times for mornings to greet the holy people, so that she's blessed and have a good life and stuff. And I know that ceremony is very popular on the Navajo reservation for the other families and stuff.
I really love that. What a beautiful way to wake up in the morning and also get fit.
Yeah.
We'll take it.
I've been to this ultra event in the Canyon de Chelly area near Chinle, Arizona, by a guy, Navajo guy named Sean Martin. He's a sort of a well-known college athlete in his own rights, and also a high school standout back in the late 1990s. But he developed this event, the 55K, which is probably around 33 miles, and go through in the canyon, and then do a in the middle of the race event, you go climb this side of the cliff and stuff.
Are you kidding me? Triathlon? What? This is much greater.
So this event sells out every year within the first 10 minutes.
You kidding?
Posted. Yep, it's posted. So he has a lottery system too now that only allows he's allowed a certain permit per runner into the event. So then he explains the origin of the canyons, the history of the Navajos, of the Canyon de Chelly area, and just a lot of different things. And you, like one of the sacred places that you hit is called Spider Woman Rock. Spider Woman is a special deity in our culture, which she brought the Navajo weaving and taught it to the to our Navajo women. So so that's an also important piece of culture, the Navajo weaving, which was also a good currency trade back in the early
Yeah.
1900s.
That's so fascinating. And have you done that run?
I did that run twice before, so
Oh, yeah, you just did it twice. Good Lord, making us all look bad. Well, congratulations. That's really interesting. And what an amazing thing to do to take the Navajo culture, the terrain, the stories of the earth there, and turn it into a run. How cool is that? Do you have to be Navajo to be in that run?
Oh no, it's open to everyone.
I'm
Like I
not
said,
asking
there's
for
a
myself. I'm asking for a
no.
friend.
It's open to everyone to experience that, but it's a lottery system too.
Yeah,
So
you just
when
have to
I
be
did the,
lucky.
you have to be lucky. So when I go out there, I only see maybe anywhere from 5 to 10 other Navajos that are in the event. So, and then you have all these international people that come in experience this run. So it's always a
And what's it called again?
Canyon de Chelly Ultra Run.
So with that, I think we're coming to a close here, although I'm kind of sad to do so because this has been so fascinating. But before we go, are there any native causes or businesses that you'd like to promote?
Okay, you probably looked at my LinkedIn. I've been a part of a lot of different organization companies, and I ran my own company before, engineering companies, and through that I met a lot of nonprofit organization, and also through my past running I met organization that do good for the people, the native people. Especially there's names like Red Earth Running Company. And there's also Bitterwater Sister up in Minnesota. Forgot she runs a organization called Native Woman Running, and it's really neat what she does out there and what she has done within the last 5 years. And now she's going on these running tours, different location on in the United States, sort of just inspiring all the Native women's about running. You don't have to be the fastest one, but also always supporting those people, the Native people out there
Fantastic.
to get your movement in and stuff like that. Just organization like that I've been able to come across through running and stuff like that. But one other one that I'm really close to my heart lately has been Rising Hearts.
Rising
It's
Hearts.
an organization to consider the land sacred, the land that you run on. And they every time you run on in certain areas, they always tell the history of the people in that area. It's when I did a lot of these long runs in on the trails and stuff out there, or even different events, I always think about who were the original people on this land. And when I'm running, I always think about like where was the water source and what kind of games were like animals were out there that they were hunting and stuff. And I would be really tired in the moment or really just trying to tell my mind not to quit. And I always think about these people that probably did this every day of their life, looking for food and looking for ways to get to the next day. And they were able to sustain that way of life through using just being on their foot and having those bone arrows or hatchet or whatever to get the next meal for their family. So that got me through, and I always think about those stuff, and then also trails that had these trading routes to these different villages. So
Right.
I was doing a lot of that, like figuring ways to how they went from one location to another through these trails and systems and stuff like that. And one big area that I can say I've been there a couple of times is Chaco Canyon in New Mexico.
Okay.
Chaco Canyon was sort of like a business hub back in the day, long many decades or centuries ago, and there was a lot of trading routes that came from that location, especially to
Yeah.
the Pueblo villages out near the Rio Grande, to the Zunis and stuff like that. So they had a, and then what they found at these locations was one thing that surprised me was a parrot feathers from Mexico.
Are you serious?
So there was actually
Interesting.
probably a trading route from Chaco Canyon down into Mexico, and it's like, wow.
That really opens my eyes when you said that you're running and you're trying to think of who was in this land before you, and knowing that, oh, this is such a hard run, but you're going to go back to your home and get an ice water and things that they would never have had the opportunity to have, and those little luxuries that we take for granted, probably. So that's opened my eyes. I'm thinking that I need to do the same. Thank you for that inspiration. So you've done a lot in your lifetime this far, and you've built a successful career in a challenging field, I might say, and you've received a lot of honors and you've made your people proud. So are there any words of wisdom or inspiration you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Yeah, it's, I think really just the younger generation, just making sure that they understand their culture and their teaching, because it goes a long ways. And because a lot of people always ask questions when I'm out there among the Anglo people. They still think we live in huts, or for the Plain Indians, it's the teepee. They believe that we still live in those type of dwellings, but I tell them, no, we live in society where we live in two worlds. One is the modern day to make a living using
Right.
today's technology, but also we have our tradition. We go back to our ceremonies and those teaching, and that's the world that we live in. And it's a living that we all have embraced, and also there's changes that happen because the technology keeps changing, so we adapt to these changes, but we should never change on our traditional side of knowing where we come from, where our ancestors have gone through to get to where we're at. That's the most important thing. And I think the most important thing to my Diné people is to keep or relearn or even start to be able to speak Diné language, even if it's a small piece.
Yes.
Maybe it's just your introduction as your clans and stuff like that. It's always important.
Because that's a piece of preservation as well.
Correct.
There's multiple ways we can preserve. Well said. Thank you for all that inspiration. And I hope you listeners enjoyed this time with Stanford. I hope you'll take it to heart and put into practice the idea of preserving your family history as Stanford has done. And you may even consider recording your own story for future generations. So may God bless you, Stanford, as you honor those who came before you, and Yako Ki for being here with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yako Ki, thank you, my friends.